Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to Critic of Everything, where we discuss media that matters. Today, we will be discussing Netflix. I'm Nat.
I'm Robin.
I'm Kaya.
And we did some pretty cool stuff this week. Kaya, what did you do this week?
Well, I went to Germany. I almost got detained because I'm technically not supposed to leave the country, but I did not get detained. I saw Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was a really great show with James Blake opening for him. Everybody was kind of like, who is this white guy? I thought it was an interesting choice. Because there's such a contrast between them two, but I see why he picked him, probably to reach out to white audiences of Europe. Like, let me just throw James Blake in there. But also maybe he didn't want us to get too hype before he came because he's a very like hype person, Kendrick himself. So he kind of like took us down and then he came out and we were like, whoa. Mm-hmm. So I actually thought that SZA would have been a good choice, a better pick for his opener, considering his audience.
It probably has a lot to do with whoever put on the show too, like if it's being contracted mm-hmm. by, I don't know, like Golden Voice or something like that, and James Blake was in Europe and Kendrick Lamar is in Europe, and they're like, well, we own both of them.
Yeah.
So what did you do this week, Robin? What do you...
I painted my living room, and I watched the Olympics. I watched a lot of Olympics this week.
What's your favorite thing to watch?
I really enjoy the ice skating pairs. I like to see the chemistry and the technical feats that both of the skaters have to do in tandem. I was really rooting for Germany for the pairs gold, and they won, which was really fun to watch. And I'm not too big into the snowboarder and like skis or the, you know, the actual sports, I guess. But I watched Shaun White win the gold, and like that was kind of a fun woohoo, go America! Like, you know, as much as you want the like most deserved athletes to win, I always kind of root for America, root for the home team, which like this year is kind of funny because it's South Korea and you're like, I'm not rooting for North Korea, but also it's an American thing that whenever the Russians come on, I'm like, beat the Russians! We don't care who wins! Beat the Russians!
They're so good though.
They're always so good.
So beautiful.
That's why it's such a relief when someone else wins, because you're like, the Russians are gonna get it. They're just too good.
Or the Canadians. I mean, everyone's basically a Canadian, because even if you're from another country, you're training in Canada.
It's true.
Yeah.
Or Breckenridge.
Or Torrance. Or upstate New York.
But you're training in North America, no matter what continent you're from.
Sure. You put the North in North America. Mm-hmm. What did you think about Johnny Weir? You had some things to say about him.
Oh, Johnny Weir.
Johnny Weir, for those of you listening, is that one really flamboyant announcer at the Olympics that makes the Olympics look like the Hunger Games.
I was really wondering. Yeah, that's true. He does kind of do that. I mean, I was wondering about his background. Like, why do we care about Johnny Weir? I wasn't an avid watcher of the Olympics for its past two cycles. I watched some of it in Sochi, but I was like, why do we care about Johnny Weir? Did he place? Did he win? But he actually got into the skating game relatively late, when he was like 12 years old. And what I said about him earlier...
12?
12.
Oh my god, he's too old.
He's too old, but he made it to the Olympics, and he's absolutely flaming and fabulous. But I, like, said some things about him pertaining to his upbringing, because when I read his Wikipedia, it said that he grew up in Pennsylvania and, like, rode a pony, and then he decided he wanted to go into figure skating, and his parents were like, okay, you can do that. And then he did both for a while, but eventually they had to give up his pony. So I just kind of assumed that he was like a rich kid, because poor people don't have ponies and figure skating careers. But apparently he like grew up in a smaller town and came from more modest beginnings than people with ponies and figure skating careers typically do.
Well, good for him.
Yeah.
Good for him. This week I watched the movie Mother, which we kind of gave a bad rap on in our first podcast where we talked about the Oscars because Mother, stylized lowercase m, exclamation point, was nominated for Razzies. And after seeing it, I have to say it's like one of the most powerful movies I've ever seen. I hate Darren Aronofsky as a human. I think he is a wormy guy, but he makes extremely powerful movies, and I thought Mother was a movie that everybody should see. I wrote about it on the blog. I think that its secret deserves to be kept because it's definitely a movie you're going to get or you're not going to get, and if you get it, you're going to get really into it. So there's a couple of articles up on the blog if you, like, got it and you want to know more, or if you didn't get it and want to know what it's all about, but it was a fabulous, fabulous, fabulous movie, and I thought it was a really important movie, and everyone should really see it. As you guys know, we are all so excited about the Oscars, and we decided to add one more movie to our list of Oscar movies that we've seen, and it was Mudbound, which ties into today's theme of Netflix. Mudbound was distributed by Netflix and produced by a few smaller companies. So, Kaya, I just wanted to start by saying last week you talked about Phantom Thread and you said that it upset you that now, like, Phantom Thread has to compete with Lady Bird. And I'm a fan of Lady Bird, obviously, but after seeing Mudbound and knowing what I know about Dee Reese, the black female director, it did make me a little pissed off that Greta Gerwig was nominated and Dee Reese wasn't, because they both did great jobs. I love Lady Bird. I love Greta Gerwig, but Mudbound was, I thought, extremely well-directed for, like, a Netflix movie.
And it was technically more impressive, I would guess, yeah, just with, like, all that on location, yeah, all that mud to deal with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think she did deserve a Best Director nomination, but they did get Best Cinematographer and Best Adapted Screenplay nomination, and also Best Supporting Actress. Dee Reese did get a nomination for something.
You felt she got her dues.
I mean, she's a black woman in Hollywood, so will she ever get her true dues? I mean, and she's actually the first, Dee Reese is the first black woman to be nominated for a Best Adapted Screenplay. Woo. And also for cinematographer. I believe the girl's name is Rachel Morrison. She's the first woman to get nominated for Best Cinematographer. So it's a very woman-led film, and I believe that they also had a woman composer for the movie as well. So I think we can only go so far. So I think that's good, like, given the Oscars.
I also think that kind of, given all of that, because, and we'll probably get more into this later, because it was a Netflix distributed film, I feel like the Academy and Hollywood in general is really reluctant to be holistically welcoming of Netflix, because as soon as they give it a really big endorsement, like a Best Director or a Best Picture, then it's kind of signifying it's fair game, the playing field is forever changed as we know it. This is, like, the direction that distributing and Hollywood and the way films are being made for this medium is going to, like, come out, and, you know, all those movies, and we could get more into this later, but, like, Oscar nominated films are typically not the type of movies that, like, you really want to spend money to go see. I mean, like, that's my biggest qualm with them. You're like, oh, I don't want to, like, spend $16 to sit in a room, dark room, with a bunch of people to hear a bunch of other people talk. And, like, maybe it's good, but I definitely want the option for a bathroom break without having to miss any, like, really important dialogue and, you know, things, yeah, like that.
Yeah. I agree. And the thing about, like, seeing an Oscar movie in the theaters is that it's often Oscar movies, quote unquote, tackle topics that are really uncomfortable, and it's uncomfortable enough to watch a movie about an uncomfortable thing. But when you're watching a movie about an uncomfortable thing in a room full of strangers, you are feeling like really uncomfortable, and you, there's kind of like pressure, I think, to have a certain reaction when you see a movie in a theater. And I feel like I really liked that Mudbound was a home, like I could watch it in my home. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have a bathroom break. It was a little long. We took a break. I liked that. It had definite act breaks. There were definitely like places that the movie allowed the audience to, you know, process, go to the bathroom, mm-hmm. maybe refresh your tea. But overall, I think it's really interesting how the movie does have a very woman-centric production team, but the movie itself is very not female-centric. The main characters are the two men who go away to war. There's a black man and a white man, and they both go away to war and have, you know, their worldviews kind of shifted by what they see there, and then they both come back to the same farm in the Mississippi Delta, and they have to deal with racism and like all the bullshit that's going on in America post World War II. And Mary J. Blige is like, she holds that movie down. Like, she's, we don't really see too much of those first two guys in the first like act of the movie, but we see a lot of her. And there's also another woman in that movie, Carey Mulligan, plays like the white mother. Kai, I know you want to talk about this a little bit more, but she, I enjoyed seeing Carey Mulligan play like a dirty farmer's wife after seeing her as like Daisy Buchanan in Great Gatsby, where she's like so glamorous and beautiful. But I hated some of her dialogue. Like, she said things like, cooking dinner for Henry was what I was put on this earth to do. And I never enjoyed Henry's lovemaking, but it made me feel like a woman. And I kind of felt like that's probably accurate. It came from a book, but like, way to be 10 steps backwards.
I actually thought, okay, so several thoughts of what you said, Natalie. So first, Dee Reese actually chose Netflix so that she could get a larger reach, because she felt that if it was in theaters, it wouldn't get as much as a big reaction, which I totally agree. So I think strategically it was better for her to put it on Netflix, because I don't think that we were going to go see it in the theaters, although it did get released in some theaters, a few theaters. But I found Carey Mulligan's part unrealistic, because they say in the beginning, right, that she's a 31-year-old virgin, and her mom's trying to marry her off, and she's like, oh, I'm so glad not to be an old maid. And I just found it unrealistic that in the times, because it's set in 1940s. I mean, it takes place over a few years. She has a job, she's 31 and single and this virgin, but I found it unrealistic that someone, given the times, given the predicament, would be so like happy about marriage. And during that time, women were being like encouraged to get married, whereas before then, like in the 20s, the median age of women actually rose a little bit, and then it went back down in the 40s. The 19th Amendment for women being able to vote was in the 1920s. So I just thought, like, time wise, even though it's written in the book, I just found that unrealistic that she would have had this time period of being this free single woman, and then her being like, oh, I love being a wife. Like, I just was like, that's not realistic.
Well, I think another, like, the biggest part about that, this whole movie, was just kind of telling how far behind the South was. Like, it was still a very Southern concept to be married. I mean, like, they get to the farm and you really don't know what year it is. You have like cars and trucks mm-hmm. and things like that, but you still have to go like who knows how many miles into town. There's no running water. Mm-hmm. There's like no electricity, from what it seems like. I mean, it's very rural. It's very, you know, 10 steps backward. And I think that's like kind of the main point, not the main point of the film, but like something you really have to like look at it into the perspective of like, this was America in the South during the war, and how stuck in the mud the South was, and I guess still is, really, just mm-hmm. in their roots.
When I was watching Mudbound, I really felt that the metaphor was for this theory called the moving sidewalk. And the moving sidewalk is basically a theory of racism that says if you stand still on a moving sidewalk, the status quo will continue and racism will continue. But if you walk forward on a moving sidewalk, you are perpetuating racism. You're making it worse. And if you, to actually change your direction on a moving sidewalk, you have to run in the other direction. So in the movie, there was the Pappy character, who's obviously the really racist, like, father, I guess, with no redeeming qualities. And he's, like, running forward on that sidewalk. Like, he wants to make racism continue in the South for the rest of time.
He's, like, lived through the Civil War.
Yeah, he's lived through the Civil War? Was that the war he was supposed to be in?
I don't know if he fought in it, but he would have been a boy if he's going to be in his, like, 70s, and it's the 40s, and the Civil War was in the 1860s.
Sure, sure. Well, anyway, so he would have, like, that guy's been in a war, and I want to talk a little bit more about, like,
he would have been
the idea of, like, what it means to be a man. And then the other brother, Henry, who's the one that Carey Mulligan is married to, he's standing still on the sidewalk. Like, he kind of gets from his wife that the things he's doing are not right, but he keeps saying, like, I don't want any trouble. You don't want any trouble. Like, he's not brave enough to go the other way. And then Garrett Hedlund, who his character's name is Jamie, and he's one of the two soldiers, or he's not a soldier. He's like,
he was a bomber pilot.
He's a high ranking. He has a high rank in the military. And he's like walking the other way as fast as he can. And that's when he, like, befriends Ronzel, the fellow black soldier. And something happens in the movie, and he's, you know, like, basically, like, he's doing what I think needs to be done to overcome racism, which is forming meaningful relationships with the other group. You know, like, there's, like, let's turn us versus them into just us. And that's what he's doing. But I also thought, like, I really liked his character. He was a really typical hero whose vice was really only, like, drinking, which was annoying, but it was a great contrast between him and his brother and his dad, especially when his dad is, like, projecting onto him, like, what it means to be a man is to be able to, like, look someone in the eye and kill them. Like, you're a pilot, so you don't know what it means. And I really love the scene where Henry is, like, pushing Jamie back on the ground, and he's, like, beating him up, and Jamie's not fighting back. Like, Jamie's getting up so Henry can push him back down again. And I thought that was a really great metaphor for, like, turning the other cheek and just really what it means to be a man. And I also thought it was cool. I mean, I'm a woman, so maybe I received it differently, that a bunch of women behind the scenes were, like, saying that about men.
I actually thought, and I went and listened to an interview with Dee Reese, and she said she really wanted to show that women bear the brunt of war. So that was one of the things she was trying to exhibit in the film, is like all these men go off to war, but it's women who have to take on all the work, and how when the neighbor, when the husband fires that other family and the pregnant wife comes, it's Laura who has to deal with the pregnant wife, and how it's Florence, Mary J. Blige character, who has to internalize her son going off to war kind of for the whole family and remain strong. So that was like one of the things that Dee Reese was trying to exhibit. I honestly found the movie hard to watch. I stopped it. And this was even before it got to the quote unquote hard parts. I just personally don't enjoy long drawn out dramas, and I was like, is this just me? And so when I went and listened to other podcasts, I listened to AB Film Review, which is a Australian film review podcast, and just to hear like a white perspective, and they really liked the film, what they got from it, because they're outside Australians, right? So they don't really have and they say it like they don't really know a lot about American history and the Jim Crow era, but what they really got from the film was how, like, black women's role in society and how, like, we know where we've come from and how, like, things are so similar. So that's what they got from the movie, like how we a comparison between, like, what was shown in the film and how things are still kind of similar now, which Dee Reese said in her interview is, like, something that she was trying to showcase, even though the film was filmed before Trump was officially elected. There's a podcast called Black Men Can't Jump in Hollywood. It's three black guys, and they also were like, no, like, this is not they like. And I totally understood where they were coming from. So one thing they were talking about was how the beginning part was too long. Like, yeah. I think the movie could have used a bit of editing. And even the Australian podcast was like, the first half of the movie could have been condensed. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, for me, the movie started when those two boys came back from war.
Yeah.
They were clearly, yeah, like, you cared about those characters towards the end of the movie. Those were the characters that, like, gave an impact. And at the start of the film, I mean, it kind of had, like, a Terrence Malick type feel with all the voiceovers and, like, the scenery. But it just didn't have the same punch. Like, I definitely felt like the first half of the film, the entire time I was searching for what's this movie really going to be about. And I think it was really lost.
I think they couldn't shake the book. I think the prose in the book was so, like, moving to the people who made the movie. And they wanted to use as much of it as possible. And they, I think also, like, they were trying to say too many things. They were trying, like, yeah, they were trying to say something about women. They were trying to say something about racism. They were trying to say something about the South. They were trying to say something about today. And, like, even towards the end of the movie, like, Carrie Mulligan's voiceover was, like, totally dropped. Like, her voice was lost. And Robin's right. The main characters were the two guys, and they weren't even really in the movie until an hour.
Yeah, I it's interesting that a white woman wrote this book, and then you have Dee Reese, who's a black woman, who's also a lesbian, coming in and giving a different spin on it. And yeah, I totally agree, Natalie. It was like too many things happening at once, where, and they said it in the Black Man Can't Jump podcast, where they're like, they didn't really need the white family. Like, they could have literally just started from the boys coming back, or not started there, but, like, pushed that further to the start.
Yeah. And, like, the whole time, you know that the movie is going to, like, culminate with this grandfather doing something racially egregious, but he's such a minor character. Like, the only dimension that he has is that he's a racist, like, stick in the mud.
Well, he's a symbol. He's not a character, that character. But I did like the movie, and what kind of kept me going was the first scene is great. It's these two guys digging this hole, and one of them falls in the mud, and the other one has to, like, pull him out of the mud, and he says when he's out, like, I thought you were going to leave me down there. And then the movie, there's, like, the opening town. I thought that was really powerful. But the next thing that happens is you see them burying someone, and you assume it's their dad. The black family goes by on their wagon, and there's a lot of, you know, like, the whole cast knows something we don't know. So the whole movie I was trying to find out, like, what do they know that I don't know? But as far as movies go, it really gripped me. I felt more in the 90 seconds that Garrett Hedlund was in the cockpit than I did during all of Dunkirk, which was, like, 3 hours long. And, like, when, like, Ronzel was in that barn, like, I felt like I was in hell. Like, the movie just really gripped me. Like, when Carrie Mulligan is, like, standing on the porch picking at her hands, and, like, I felt like you could really feel, like, the hot oppression of, like, the heat and the mud and the rain and all these things that are out of your control. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, another thing that was pointed out is that In Black Man Can't Jump in Hollywood, and I was also trying to figure out, like, why was I so, like, ugh. One of the guys, he said black people, he's so tired of seeing black people not having agency in films, and he's tired of black bodies being victimized in films, and I totally agree with that. And I also felt like these white characters come to these black characters, but, like, the black characters aren't even fully, like, thought out. Like, when Roselle, he's just like listening to Jamie, like most of their interactions, it's just like Jamie going on. Well, in like the first few of their interactions, it's like Jamie going on and then Roselle just like listening. And then Jamie eventually asks Roselle about like, oh, like what's going on with you? But it doesn't feel genuine. And when, Laura, the wife, comes to Florence, like, she comes to her for this healing, but it's like, we don't really get inside the mind of Florence. Like, I don't know, I don't feel like it's fully executed well.
I mean, yeah, I would say we don't really get inside anybody's mind. It's, there's just, there are just too many characters, and like I said, it's trying to do too many things. So, I agree with you. I thought that, like, their relationship was weak.
Yeah, yeah. I felt like all the characters were like relatively flat because you were trying to find out so much about so many of them. But I also kind of got like the story and the interactions between the Black family and the white family was like the Black people, the Black family's stance was really just like, this is not our world. Like, this is not our time and keep your mouth shut. Like, and maybe, you know, that was kind of the point and why we didn't delve too much into their past and their feelings just because... that was, you know,
I also kind of expected it until like that big event happened at the end. I was thinking, oh, maybe this movie will be different. Like maybe this will be just a movie about a white man and a Black man having a really meaningful relationship in the Deep South, but it really wasn't. Yeah. And I think, I have like mixed feelings about the ending. At first I thought it was like, seeing it, obviously, I was, like, happy that it ended the way that it did, but I almost thought it was, like, too happy, and it kind of escalated, like, really quickly, and...
like, how did you make it to Germany?
Yeah, I mean, and it was just, well, even, like, before that, I was just, like, okay, like, now this is...
Now this is
a movie that's just, like, 12 Years a Slave, pretty much.
And another thing is, I honestly don't feel like Mary J. Blige, although she did a great job, I'm so tired of it, and I talked about it in one of the earlier podcasts. I don't think that she deserved the Oscar nomination. I feel like Oscars was like, who do we have? Black women traditionally get nominated for Oscars when they're playing The Help, a domestic worker. I mean, the two Black women that are nominated for Oscars this year, Octavia Spencer, Mary J. Blige, playing basically the same character set in different times. I just want better for us. So I'm glad that it has a Black lesbian director and it has all these women working on the film and, you know, a female cinematographer and composer and yada, yada, yada. And I'm not discrediting that, but I want us to create more narratives for Black characters.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in order to do that, we really have to get out of the past. I think right now, kind of the trajectory or, you know, the mindset is to educate everyone on what our history really entails and what the plight for these people really was and how we got to where we are today. Yeah. And I feel like maybe that's kind of what everyone's focusing on, like, you know, Black cinema in 20... or like,
I mean, I've always thought that there are Black people, Black movies for Black people, and there are Black movies for white people, and this was a Black movie for white people.
Yeah,
I totally agree with that. I also hated that they referred to each other as brother. I like, hey, brother, what? I was like, no. And also, at one point, this is a technical thing. At one point, when he's walking in the rain, Roselle's walking in the rain.
Oh, he's not wet! Him up.
He's dry!
Yeah, he's dry as a bone. Yeah, I noticed that too.
Pouring rain.
Best cinematography.
Yeah, really.
Anyway, so that kind of... but as I want to conclude by saying, as the Netflix movies go, I was very pleasantly surprised. And the kind of point of this podcast is to assess Netflix's role in the movie world. So before we get into that, I wanted to just give the listeners a little bit of a brief history of Netflix. Netflix is a streaming service that probably all of you have. It was founded in 1997 by Reed Hastings and Mark Rudolph. In 2000, little-known fact, Blockbuster had a chance to buy Netflix, but they kind of laughed it off. Ha 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 ha, you'll never amount to anything. The internet is for babies. And then in 2007, they introduced streaming, so you no longer needed a DVD to watch their content. In 2013, they added film and TV production, so that's when we first started to see Netflix originals. Today is available in 190 countries legally, and you can also buy illegal subscriptions in many countries like Colombia. And their business model is based on the subscription model. So they charge an average of $9.99 per month per account. So their main revenue is subscriptions and also resale distribution. Studios will pay Netflix to host their intellectual property, and they are the highest bidder. According to the Wall Street Journal, Netflix spent $3.3 billion on content acquisition, more than twice what Hulu and Amazon were paying, and it is the most popular streaming service in the world. Roughly 75% of homes that have internet have Netflix. And in case you're wondering, the competitors, YouTube is the second most popular. 53% of homes use YouTube, 33% use Amazon, 17% use Hulu. And I'm not sure what the stats are on how many of them use like more than one, but Netflix is the strongest, and that's kind of why we chose to focus on it for this podcast.
Yeah, it's interesting you say how much money they make, $6.7 billion, and that was in 2015.
Yeah.
So that 3 years, I'm sure they're making even more than that. But some of you may or may not have heard about Monique and her ordeal with Netflix and how they offered her $500,000 to do a comedy special. And we're going to get into Bright later, where they offered Will Smith $20 million to do Bright. They offered Amy Schumer. They actually offered Amy Schumer maybe, I want to say, about like $5 or $6 million. And she went and they offered her $10 million. And she went and renegotiated after she learned how much Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle had earned on their special. She renegotiated an extra $2 or $3 million. So for them to come to Monique, she wanted us to boycott Netflix, which nobody was going to do. Not the smartest strategy on her part. But they were trying to screw her over because they could have paid her so much more. And actually, she released the details of the deal, and it was a horrible deal. Like, nobody would have accepted this. For 12 months after her special premiered, she would not be allowed to tape or negotiate any other comedy special with anyone else. After the 12 months was up, Netflix would have dibs on her next comedy special. And she would only be able to do it with someone else, like HBO, for example, only if Netflix passed on it first. And for 24 months after the special premiered, Monique would not be able to do a Netflix special. She would not be able to do any of the jokes she did in her Netflix special anywhere else. So basically, they were going to own her for 2 years and for only $500,000. And that's totally trash for a company.
That's not an uncommon deal, but for that amount of money, it is pathetic.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they were not doing that for Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle. I don't think that they're, I mean, yeah, if they were offering more money, but I just think it's funny.
I think that, yeah, the price is definitely wrong, but one of Netflix's big positions is that they do want to be the comedy hub. Like, that is that's a genre that they want to kind of monopolize. Like, that's where they see their in. If you've noticed, like, most of their, like, not most of their original programming, but they do parlay so many comedy specials, like, more so than HBO.
Oh.
And, like, that's what they want to capture the market with.
I mean, they're tremendously cost-effective. The comedian is the only thing you have to pay for.
Yeah.
And then you have to have, like, a small crew. It's hugely cost effective, and yeah, that's a bullshit price.
Yeah, that's way too low. So I'm sure, like, they do have that, like, intellectual property contract, with like Dave Chappelle and all their other like big names, but like
that's part of what they're buying with that is millions of dollars. Yeah, that is exclusivity.
But like for $500,000,
fuck no.
She's like, I could make that on a TV show.
Yeah, damn. Yeah. Thank you for educating us about that. Yeah, damn. Netflix is kind of like I said, they started making their own stuff in 2003, but they have, you know, when you see Netflix original, I think this is something that people are really confused about. When you see Netflix original, that is either material that Netflix has either created on their little Netflix studio, or it's material for which they have the exclusive rights to distribute in that country. For example, I love the show Chewing Gum. It is a show that's on a network in Britain, but here in America, they're allowed to call it a Netflix original because that is the only way you can watch it in America. And many people have commented that the quality of their acquired content is quite a bit higher than the quality of their house-made content. What do you guys think?
I agree. I mean, say what you want about, like, the new season of Arrested Development, but, like, that was one of their first shows, I think, that they, like, kind of took over to, you know, and it's plastered around Netflix original Arrested Development, even though you have 3 previous seasons that were on Fox and everyone knows that, or even like Longmire or something like that. I mean, where you have a staunch difference between the network being involved and then Netflix, like you can definitely tell where the storylines get a little too soap opera, where the cinematography and the direction, like in my opinion, Netflix shit is all filmed the same way. It has the exact same gradient. Like you can tell a Netflix production just by like the colors on your screen and how like everything kind of flows together, which, you know, is kind of a studio thing to do. I think, you know, if you really research it well enough, you could figure out like which films are Fox, which films are Disney, just based off of certain things like that. But Netflix has always been kind of like a tailor-made Netflix type production to me. Like Orange is the New Black, House of Cards, they all, like, look the same to me, even though one is, like, filmed in a much lighter scale than the other. Like, they're filmed the exact same way. They have that, like, cut. It's all just very, like, basic to me. I don't know. I've never been particularly impressed with Netflix original programming, if you haven't been able to tell.
I think they have gotten better over the years. And they're... I also think they do have a bit more freedom than a network show on CBS or ABC. So that's one thing I like about them. One thing I don't like is how they shove the Netflix originals in your face every chance they get. And I actually saw a Reddit thread about how Netflix claims to have thousands of titles, but we only see like the same 30 Netflix originals on our profile. And apparently they have some types of codes that you can do to look up the different of all these subgenres they have. But I'm okay with the Netflix originals. I just want them to stay in like one category in its own thing, separated from everything else, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, they're shameless promoters. I mean, you'll finish watching something like Requiem for a Dream, and then they're like, you might like the Dave Chappelle comedy special, or The Twins That Made Us, or Orange is the New Black, and you're like,
yeah,
maybe I'll like something that wasn't produced by Netflix.
Well, it's funny because something that lots of people are talking about is the main... like, Netflix is facing competition because Disney wants to have its own studio. And everybody knows that Disney makes the movies that everyone wants to see. They have Marvel, they have Star Wars, they have Disney, they have Pixar, they have all of the top dogs. So the idea is that if Disney takes those things out of Netflix, then everyone will follow the Disney content to basically what I am calling Disney's version of Tidal. And Netflix will really have to ramp up their game. And then it will, like, I think the direction it's going is, like, that's kind of pushing Netflix to be all original content. And that's probably why they're focusing on the comedy specials, because those are good.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's a lot better than their scripted content. And it's, like, tried and true writers, a.k.a. the comedians. But I think I want to talk about that deal a little bit later, but I kind of see it happening the way that HBO Go happened. So a similar thing is happening with HBO and Amazon. HBO decided that they weren't going to offer any of their shows on streaming services, not Hulu, not YouTube, not Netflix, not no one. And of course, they had heavy hitters like Game of Thrones. They had Westworld, which everybody was talking about. Sex and the City was an HBO property for a while. And they figured that, oh, we have all of the goodies, like, come over here to HBO Go. And it was a shitty streaming service. It had tons of glitches. It was $20 a month. It was too expensive. And now they're on Amazon. So what do you guys think is going to happen with the Disney Netflix breakup?
I mean, you still have to pay extra for the HBO on Amazon.
True.
They still have, like, the basic staples. You can watch The Wire. You can watch Sex and the City. You can watch, like, the OG HBO shows. But if you want to stay tried and current, you do have to get that HBO Go subscription. But I think we also forget, like, just how much content Disney owns already and has produced. I mean, they have Touchstone Pictures. They have Buena Vista Pictures. And like
ABC shows.
I mean, they have their own universe. If they hadn't have sold Miramax, like, you know, 4 years, like 5 years ago, then imagine like what they could have owned today. I mean, it's just so crazy. And they're in no shortage of funds.
No, they're like the evil empire.
And like, yeah, just like with the acquisition of Fox, which is, oh my God, I pray that the FCC does not approve that, because what I thought was super shady about that whole deal was, like, you know that deal has been going down for years. And as soon, like, the second they had...
The last X-Men movie?
No, the second they had a Republican administration where money is king, they were like, put it through. This is the time to get this approved, because no one in their right mind, if they had a, like... thought to anyone other than the big corporations would approve this, but like, now is the time. So I don't know. It's scary. It is really scary. Like, but that being said, like, Netflix does have the side of being a tech company, you know, people who are specialized in tech production and, you know, coding and things like that. They might not have the same sphere with Disney. They do pay well, but they are also a terrible place to work.
I also think Netflix has the benefit of being first to the game. I mean, the whole thing with subscription-based businesses that investors love is that it's really the money is getting pulled out of the consumer's account without them having to go each month to pay for it. So that's why when Monique was like, hello, my loves, I need you to boycott Netflix, we were like, no, girl. We were like, most of us aren't even using our own account. Like, we're using someone else's account. So I think if Disney comes along and just to zoom out a little, a lot of these, you know, like you're saying, we have Hulu, Amazon, everything, right? It would be nice to just have one that has it all. I mean, it is a little monopolistic, but it is annoying to have to go to, like, this website and that website. Like, and I know there's only, like, three, but if Disney comes along, it's going to be like, oh, okay, now we have to go to Disney. You know, like, if I want to watch Sex and the City, I have to go on Amazon. And if I want to watch Black Mirror, I have to go to Netflix. Like, you know, it's too many accounts. And entrepreneurship, as my professor said, is getting people to part with money and getting them to change their behavior. So it's like, how, I think that's why Tidal failed, Spotify. I mean, Tidal also had like leadership problems. I believe they had like 10,000 CEOs within a year, but it's like Spotify had already came and they had killed it. Like, you couldn't compete with Spotify. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, music is definitely different than movies, but I don't know. Disney's going to have to come and really knock it out of the park.
Yeah. It's funny because actually Apple Music competes with Spotify. And I am amazed when I talk to people how many of them are still listening to music on YouTube. I'm like, are you kidding me? You're searching YouTube?
Well, Well, now they have YouTube Red, which is like, you know, accommodating for that market. But, you know, it's like saying changing your behavior as a consumer. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people discredit Amazon and don't see them as a primary player in the video market. But Amazon is changing the way that we consume everything. I mean, if you want to do kind of like, not direct comparison, but I would probably compare like Netflix to Microsoft and Amazon to Apple. Like Apple came in and was like, we're going to change the way that you live, period, point blank, the way that you interact with your technology, the way that you think about, you know, your information being stored, the way you think about everything. And like Amazon wants to do that in the way you consume your products, the way you consume your healthcare, the way you consume your food, the way you consume your media, you know? So I think like, I mean, it's so crazy how much market share they are trying to capture. And I think they do have the capacity to do it. So I think by like Disney focusing on Netflix in the long haul, maybe they should be refocusing and trying to figure out something with Amazon. Like, that's where my sites would be, like, you know.
Well, I think I agree with you, but I also think that, like, YouTube is owned by Google. Let's talk about the other elephant in the room, Google, that tracks your every move, and it knows what you want to, what you're thinking about buying before you utter it to a single human soul. And also, Amazon has that robot, Alexa, which I am not comfortable with.
People love Alexa, though. And
I do not love Alexa.
And Google is trying to parlay. And the thing that, like, Amazon has and that Apple had are physical products. Like, at the forefront, Netflix doesn't have physical products. They are strictly a service, whereas Disney does. They have DVDs, but, like, who buys DVDs anymore? That's why you have Netflix.
But people are, I actually heard someone say the other day, like, oh, I have all the seasons of blah, blah, blah on Amazon, like on my Amazon account. So I think and I have like some movies I bought. Actually, I think they disappear after 48 hours, but you could buy it permanently on Amazon. And there's definitely some shows. Reboots, which could be like a whole nother episode, but some shows that aren't streamed anywhere that you can just buy the whole season of on Amazon and have it digitally. So yeah, I think that's a good point, is Amazon is in the game. I also think, and there's another streaming service, is it called Switcher? I can't remember the name.
For film or for music?
It's like for film, for movies and shows. It has some shows. It may not be called Switcher. I may have made up that name, but there's another one that's not going to make it. But but yeah, I think there's an opportunity for, there's a lot of shows that have not been streamed. Yeah. And I think there's an opportunity because we're all so fucking nostalgic to stream. Like, where's Fresh Prince of Bel-Air? I don't know. Like, whoever picks that up would do really well. Like, I want to see shows like that or like The Wild Thornberrys. I don't know. Maybe I'd watch it and fucking hate it now.
But Amazon did have a lot of those. Like, when they were first starting, I remember you could watch a lot of, like, nostalgic type, like, old Nickelodeon.
I mean, that's my Full House. That's why they adapted Fuller House, because they were like, holy crap, everyone wants to watch Full House.
But I think that's also, like, an interesting thing. Like, you don't have the option of ownership with Netflix like you do with Amazon.
Yeah.
And people like that. Yeah. They like to own.
Yeah. I mean, like, the internet has been out in my apartment, and you know, we can only use Google server things, and YouTube has been a godsend, and I've been watching more DVDs than I have lately, because sometimes the internet doesn't work and you do just need to own things in order to consume
hard copies,
you know. I think like we're just in this bubble where the internet
we're
is
in
always
the cloud.
Gonna work.
We're in the cloud. Called the cloud.
But we're in the cloud and it's always gonna work except for
but
when
it's not
it
Yeah, I actually heard Netflix, you can now offline download.
But it's still at the
mercy. But if you decide you don't want to pay for Netflix anymore.
Right.
Or if they take it off. I'm sure it's at the mercy of what the licensing.
And now it's like, okay, do you want to watch a Netflix original, one of maybe five blockbusters that came out in the last 10 years, or a B-movie?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the quality has definitely gone out the window. But they're, I mean, they spent $90 million on Bright. Before we get to Bright, I just have to talk about Disjointed for like 5 seconds. Just like I was so surprised. And it's like season two of Disjointed on, and I was like, who watched this show? Who was watching it? And apparently they just filmed all the episodes at once and they just released them in two parts, which I was like so thankful for. But what a horrible misuse of an acting legend who I can't remember her name right now. What's her name? Kathy Bates. What? And it just totally missed the mark, and the laughing track was the whole thing was horrible. So anyways, going back to Bright.
That's how I felt about Love. When they renewed it,
Love,
I was like,
show was terrible.
Who the fuck watched this show? How could they have two seasons of this?
Yeah, I haven't seen Love, but
I liked Easy. You recommended that.
Easy's really good. I liked Easy a lot. I think it's incredibly written. And also, Master of None is also a really good, well-done Netflix show.
I mean, Netflix has Stranger Things, let's not forget. That show's competing with Game of Thrones and Top Dogs. Like, yeah. And people like it.
I will say that, kind of coming back to what you said about, and we'll get to Bright, but Academy films are films that deal with tough content that you wouldn't necessarily watch in front of a large, you know, audience. And I feel like because Netflix is an internet-based company, an internet-based service, it has a better dial in on, like, what people are really looking for and, like, the socio-cultural trends that are really going on. And I think that is kind of their strong suit, you know? Like, you talk about things that Netflix does, you know? You talk about the... Netflix is really good at hitting topics, you know, and getting people to talk about those topics. So I think there is kind of like a network effect that goes in with that.
Right on. And let's not forget that they know exactly what you are watching, how long you are watching it, what you're putting on your list.
Yes.
Studios only know, I mean, unless you're using your credit card, they only know how many people, and they don't really know who those, I mean, there's ways of finding out, of course, but Netflix has the data.
But Amazon also knows what you're buying.
You're
browsing.
You're not alone, ever. Mean,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
So I think the internet services definitely have that advantage but anyway, back to Bright.
I have to admit, I am a huge fan of sci-fi fantasy. So that's what's kind of keeping me going. I'm not a fan of the buddy cop movie. I like Will Smith, but at this point he is just playing Will Smith and I couldn't get through his Will Smith-isms. Like, you know you don't want to do this. And I thought Robin made the point that the orc character should have been the main character because, gee, there's a story we've never heard from before.
It was really the writing for me. I was like, this isn't going to get better. These characters aren't going to get developed to like the point where I want them to be. This story, I mean, I know you didn't like the way it was shot, but I think like you can tell that they spent a lot of money making this movie, $70 million excluding Will Smith's cost. Like, I mean, it looked better than a sci-fi original movie, for sure, but it didn't read better than one. It read like a lousy TV movie that just like, I mean, they stuck to like two syllable words.
I actually heard someone, I was like talking to this group and they... Like, it was a group of sisters, and one of the sisters convinced the other sisters that Bright got really, really good at the end. And I was like, wait, does it? And they were like, no.
Yeah, I, in Three Black Geeks podcast, they said that it seemed like a 14-year-old wrote it. And I have to agree, because Will Smith said in an interview with Yahoo that it's supposed to be a hybrid between Training Day and Lord of the Rings. And he probably should not have said that, but it felt
like Training Day, for sure.
Because David Ayer wrote and directed Training Day, but he directed Bright, but he did not write it.
Yeah. So I feel like they were trying to be like, did either of you see Zootopia?
Yes. We also felt Zootopia vibes.
Yeah, I feel like that's was that, like, so this 14-year-old that they locked in a room, they threw Training Day in there, they threw Lord of the Rings, and they threw Zootopia, and they're like,
Figure it out.
Combine these.
Well, you know, I think the orcs are really cool.
I think they're really misunderstood race.
But I'm going to throw out everything. Oh, and the elves, I like that they're, like, tall and blonde.
And they're kind of persnickety. Yeah.
But they're kind of persnickety, but I'm going to, like, oh, I just didn't feel like watching the rest of Lord of the Rings, so.
With Zootopia, I think they were trying to do something similar and, like, using this, like, mystical figure, non-human idea to explain racism. So I think that's what they were trying to do with orcs. And like, orcs being this, like, bottom of the food chain, but they were, like, I just don't think it was, like, executed really well. And I would just say, also in the three black nerds, they also pointed out, if the orcs were supposed to be at the bottom of the, like, totem pole, then why were blacks and Latinos still in the hood? Like,
there weren't, like, any real white people in that movie. They were all elves. Like, the white people were elves, and then, like, everyone else just lived in the ghetto. You know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Dang.
I mean, I kind of, like, yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Like, we were just talking about Mudbound and how there wasn't enough character development for the black people in that movie. Like, I feel the same way about Bright. There wasn't enough character development in the orcs. And, I mean, they had an opportunity here to really do something. Like, orcs,
yeah.
That's never been done before. What, like, orcs as the good guys? What a fucking great idea. Okay, not never. Yeah. They did it in Warcraft, which was a lot better than I think most people think. It's a really good movie.
Oh, the movie?
Warcraft.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Kind of humanizing the orcs.
Well, apparently there was a backstory that Netflix cut from the original film, the finished product. But apparently, you know, it just made it a little bit more clear about what we should be feeling. I don't think it would have really added that much to the film.
Well, I feel like with fantasy movies, it takes longer to really introduce it to the audience, the whole concept of the world. And I feel like them placing it in LA was maybe a strategy for them to kind of, like, lessen it, lessen the fact that they would have to explain this mystical world. So they're like, LA, but mystical.
I mean, I really liked that it was in LA. I mean, I really am so, I'm disappointed that it just didn't read well, because I think it did have a lot of potential. I kind of liked seeing Los Angeles in this, like, weird parallel, but still very dystopian, like, living in LA.
They nailed it.
They nailed it. Like, Los Angeles in that part, like, it's not a nice place to live, you know? Like, Beverly Hills and the West Side, like, where the elves live, that's nice, but, like, for the most part, LA is, like, a pretty grimy, like, dingy place. And, like, you know, kind of going back to character development, there was no main character. Like, the main character of that movie was Will Smith, and it shouldn't have been. If we really wanted to get the full sense of the backstory and the world, we should have had our focus be on the orc. We could have followed him and seen what his day-to-day looked like, what his home life looked like, and then got a better sense of what his family was. And in that case, then we could have extrapolated and seen, like, orc life, and this is the balance between the two.
I did not like the fact that it was in LA, and I felt like it weakened the plot. I actually would have preferred, well, okay, so first, I listened to this podcast called Claqueta de Asina, which is, I don't, there's somewhere in Latin, a Latin American podcast. It's in Spanish, but one of the guys, he noted that it would have been nice to see it in a different city. And LA is just like, oh, I'm going to do a cop story. It's going to be set in LA or Miami or New York. I think he made a good point. Like, it would have been nice to see, like, a different kind of cop story. And going back to getting that international perspective, here's some, it's two of them, but, like, here's two guys who are like, oh, look, another fucking American cop movie about cops in LA, you know? And he was like, it's a very cliche police story. And I'm like, yeah, like, where it's like, are you my partner? or are you with the people? Like when he says, are you a cop first? Are you an orc first? And in Will Smith, he's been in so many cop movies. Even the interviewer, when he was interviewing with Yahoo, asked him, like, how many cop movies are you going to do? And he's like, well, this one's different. Like, it's telling a different kind. I mean, but just to remind people, he was in all three Men in Black, where he's playing a cop. He was in both Bad Boys playing a cop, and he was also in I, Robot playing a cop. So he's really good at playing the cop, but it's usually like him and his partner, and they don't get along. And
at this point, what you are describing is a Will Smith movie.
Exactly. But going back to the three black geeks and what you were saying, they called it the Will Smith banter. They were like, the Will Smith banter couldn't save this movie. You called it the Will Smith charm. But
I feel a franchise coming on. They renewed it. A bunch of people watched this movie. Like, don't kid yourself. It was not a failure. I think they said that if it had been in the box office, it would have made like the third most money of the year because a lot of people watched it on the opening weekend. So those things that we are kind of turned off by, cop movie starring Will Smith, Los Angeles, boy things. Like, this was a boy movie, and I feel like this was a movie for the masses, and the masses liked it.
But you know how, like, the system's totally different, though. Like, the cost of watching this movie at home is 2 hours of your time, whereas the cost, if you're like seeing it in the theaters, you've read the reviews, are you still going out to see this movie for, you know, $6 to $25?
True.
You know, like, I wouldn't have watched this movie. I wouldn't have even attempted to watch this movie or thought about it had it not been at the convenience of my computer.
But what I'm saying is the metrics show that this movie is popular. Netflix will make more of this kind of movie.
And Netflix is so sketchy about their metrics. I mean, they never have been outright with, like, what their viewership really is. They've always been like, oh, well, you know, we don't have to release this. It's there. Trust us. We're being honest. Like, people are watching our show.
Yeah, in this case, it was a third party that got the data and, like, did their own kind of research. But I think if, like, Netflix is trying to compete with Disney, I don't think this movie was based on a comic book, although it feels like it could have been. I mean, like, they're going to have to start doing, like, the superhero thing, the sci-fi thing. And I think this was a cool try. And personally, like, I'm not a fan of Marvel. I'm not a fan of superhero movies. I've seen them all. And this guy directed Suicide Squad also. So he kind of had, like, the alternative superhero movie vibe coming into it. But I really wanted
Suicide Squad also got, like, horrible reviews. So.
Yeah, but people watched it. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's like, that's why we're doing this, is because we don't...
Yeah.
We want good movies to be made. And I just, like, I want this franchise to be good. So please fix it, Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the concept. I really did enjoy, like, I like Lord of the Rings. And I thought that even the way they, like, did the makeup and made them, it didn't seem like too fantasy.
Yeah, they did makeup, which was good for them.
Like, it looked a lot more realistic than it sounded. You know, when you think about, like, elves living with us in today's society, you're like, what the heck? But they, like, they have sillier names than they do appearances.
I think that the action scenes in the movie were a little bit overbearing. It also, like, wasn't enough magic. I don't know. But I think at the end of the day, if you put Will Smith, like, Will Smith is very strategic about the movies he does, right? He's not a Kevin Hart that just fucking goes into any movie that they pay him to be in. Or The Rock, who does the same thing. You know, Will Smith, does a movie, like, every couple of years. And the American public in the world, I'm assuming, loves Will Smith. Like, we love seeing him in movies. So when he did Suicide Squad, he hadn't done a movie for a while, like, to my knowledge. So he comes out in Suicide Squad, and it also has Margot Robbie, who people love. And it also the story of, like, superhero, blah, blah, blah.
Villains.
So I think, I think people want to see Will Smith. I think he's, like, if you're going to put in a movie, like, and you put Will Smith in it, I think people trust him in films, and that's who we want to... Do you know what I mean? Like, we trust his films.
Yeah.
And that's who we want to see. It's very much a movie built around Will Smith.
I mean, when you're a quarter of your budget goes into the main actor, then yes. But also, like, if he's so fucking picky about the movies he's doing, did he not read this script before he, like, okayed it?
On paper, if I can see how, you know how it's supposed to be Zootopia-esque and, like, what racism is like. And I think that is supposed to be the message of it. It just gets lost with all the other...
I don't know.
Things.
On paper, if I were reading this line for line, I would have been like, rewrite.
But if you're Will Smith and you're like, this looks great, like, I've done this character 10 times and, like, it has a great message. Like, it's very on brand for Will Smith. Like, don't quote me on this, but I want to say he may be one of the first big A-list stars to do a movie for Netflix.
It's Star Power, you know. And that was a genius move for them to get Will Smith. They also got Shonda Rhimes to sign an exclusivity deal with them. I really like the subscription model. I feel like that is making me influential in the decisions that Netflix is making. I guess we just, like, to those with great power comes great responsibility, and there's a lot of pressure on Netflix. Don't fuck it up, guys.
Yeah. I think they're going to step it up, too. I think Netflix has a clear vision of what it wants to be. And I think right now we're just witnessing the baby steps.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much for listening. We really do appreciate y'all. We know this season can be rough, but remember, there are plenty of things to keep you entertained on Netflix, on Amazon, on Hulu, on YouTube. So take advantage of the cold weather to just stay inside and veg out. Remember, you can catch the episode notes for this episode on acriticofeverything.wordpress.com. We love y'all. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week.
Nobody ever watches the end credits on Netflix, and that means no one's gonna hear this song. In fact, you probably already moved on to another show or movie that you're watching tonight. You're too busy to watch credits. I mean, who's got the time? Why did we even title cards you also won't want.